From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a conversation with Tavis Smiley. His broadcasts have made him an opinion leader, particularly in the African American community. He's a commentator on the nationally syndicated Tom Joyner Morning Show and now hosts his own NPR program. Smiley has a new book called Keeping the Faith. As Afghanistan's first minister for women's affairs and its current head of the Human Rights Commission, Seema Sumar's life is constantly in jeopardy. We'll talk with her about what she's up against. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new Charlie Christian box set, and TV critic David Bianculli previews tonight's season opener of the Fox series 24. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. John Allen Muhammad appeared in federal court today in Greenbelt, Maryland. He's the older of two suspects charged in the recent sniper attacks in the Washington, D.C. area. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
Muhammad's initial hearing was much like that of last week. U.S. Marshals escorted him into the courtroom, released his wrists from handcuffs, and guarded him as he answered, "Yes, sir," to a series of procedural questions from the judge. This time, though, the charges are different. The 20-count complaint includes discharging a firearm as part of an extortion scheme that resulted in 7 deaths in Maryland and the District of Columbia. The charges of extortion refer to the sniper's alleged demand for $10 million to stop the violence. Muhammad was also charged in the 3 non-fatal shootings in the area. The charges against Muhammad carry a maximum sentence of the death penalty. Details of the case of 17-year-old John Lee Malvo are not available because he's a minor. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, Greenbelt, Maryland.
A federal appeals court in San Francisco ruled today that the Justice Department may not investigate or punish doctors who recommend marijuana to help treat patients' illnesses. The court said that the federal government may not revoke a doctor's license to prescribe medication or investigate doctors for recommending marijuana for medical uses. Federal prosecutors had argued that doctors were interfering with drug law enforcement and contradicting the government's judgment that marijuana has no medical benefits. The appeals court said that prosecutors would interfere with a doctor's right to communicate frankly and openly with patients. 8 states have legalized medical marijuana. The Bush administration signaled once again today that the United States is prepared to move against Iraq with or without the support of the United Nations. Military action without UN backing could be more challenging, but U.S. officials insist it can be done. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
Secretary of State Colin Powell says if the Security Council does not approve military action against Iraq, President Bush could still act with like-minded nations. At the Pentagon, Army General Tommy Franks, who would direct an Iraq war, said a recent trip to the region convinced him the United States has a great many friends and allies who see the situation the same way we do. Still, Franks made clear he'd prefer an operation with international backing.
The best case for us is to be able to build our coalition based on work by the Security Council within their charter.
Defense officials say a war against Iraq without the UN would still be winnable, but broader support would mean more cooperation from neighboring countries, easier access to the war zone, and more help during the post-war phase. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow gained a fraction after dropping 170 points earlier in the day. It closed at 8,369. The Nasdaq lost 15 points. This is NPR News. The U.S. Coast Guard has been rounding up dozens of illegal migrants who came ashore this afternoon in South Florida. The migrants are believed to be Haitians who swam ashore from a boat that was just off the Miami Causeway. It's a major highway in the area. Miami police said the Coast Guard had been watching the boat. Scientists have announced a $100 million effort to create a new map of human DNA. The map could accelerate efforts to identify genes involved in diseases. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
The new map will be a catalog of almost all genetic variations among people. This new approach to analyzing DNA is based on the observation that human DNA comes in about 200,000 discrete chunks. Each chunk usually comes in just 4 or 5 different forms, called haplotypes. Researchers from 5 different countries, including the United States, have agreed to a massive collaboration which will let them identify all of these genetic variations. They say the project will take about 3 years. When it's done, the map may speed up the search for traits that are involved in diseases. Researchers also hope that the map will lead to blood tests to help doctors tailor drug treatments based on a person's genetic pattern. Richard Harris, NPR News, Washington.
Former Vice President Walter Mondale is reportedly preparing to announce a run for the seat of the late Senator Paul Wellstone in Minnesota. The Associated Press is quoting a state Democratic Party official as saying that Mondale will launch his campaign tomorrow and hold a public rally on Thursday. Mondale, who formerly served as a U.S. senator from Minnesota, would be running against former St. Paul Mayor Norm Coleman, a Republican. Wellstone was killed in a plane crash on Friday. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Enterprise Florida, the economic development partnership for Florida, helping grow Florida's innovation economy, on the web at eflorida.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Through his work as a broadcaster, my guest Tavis Smiley has become an opinion leader, particularly in the African-American community. He's a commentator on the nationally syndicated Tom Joyner Morning Show. His Smiley Report is heard daily on urban contemporary radio stations through the ABC radio network. He's a contributor to CNN and formerly hosted his own show on BET. Now he hosts his own national public radio program featuring interviews and commentaries. There's more. He also runs the Tavis Smiley Foundation, whose mission he describes as encouraging, empowering, and enlightening black youth. Smiley started his career as an aide to Los Angeles Mayor Tom Bradley. In his new book, Keeping the Faith, Smiley collects the comments of African-American writers on such themes as black love, faith, inspiration, and grief and healing. He also shares some of his own personal stories, such as coming of age in a trailer with 10 children, including the 4 his parents adopted. Okay, this is what I got to know. What are some of the differences for you doing a show on NPR versus working on commercial radio or cable TV?
Well, one thing you would never hear me say, from National Public Radio, I'm Tavis Smiley. I don't talk that way. My energy level, my vocal quality, my sound, my energy, my flavor, as we like to say in the black community, the flavor that I bring to the program is very different.
Oh, I bring flavor to the
show.
Yeah. No, I do.
Indeed you do, Terry Gross. And so my style is different. So I think stylistically, we have noticed the biggest difference in what I do on commercial radio and what I do on public radio. The other difference is that most of my commercial outlets allow me to express my opinion. I am a commentator, if you will, in most of these commercial outlets. On public radio, I enjoy the opportunity to sit back and to ask the questions because I don't know if this is true or not, Terry. It probably is not. But when I go to bed at night, since hosting a show on NPR, I at least feel smarter. Maybe I am. I don't know. But I certainly feel smarter hosting a show on NPR because I get a chance to ask questions. And I believe ultimately that knowledge is power.
I'm wondering what you think the image of NPR is among your friends, colleagues, and I'm interested in particularly among African-American friends and colleagues, if you listened before, if people you're close to listen, and what the image is and how you think that compares to the reality.
The reality is that many of my African-American friends and colleagues don't know what NPR is, have never heard of NPR. They know the NBA, but they don't know NPR. There are too many people in the African-American community, and for that matter, in communities of color, that do not know what NPR is all about. And the tragedy is that because I believe that information is power, that means there are a lot of people in this country not being empowered through this thing we call National Public Radio. The reality is that it is called National Public Radio, not National One-Third of the Public Radio. And I have been very frank about saying on the air and off the air that public radio, NPR in particular, has to do a better job of using this radio medium to allow Americans to be introduced to each other.
You come from a background of public speaking. Your mother was a minister. She preached at the pulpit. You started in politics before getting involved in broadcasting, so you had to do a lot of public mm-hmm. speaking to, like, big gatherings of people. And although on radio or TV you're talking to a lot of people, you're talking to them one-on-one, and it's a very intimate kind of medium compared to speaking in a big hall. I'm wondering if you feel like you had to learn a different style of speaking when you started doing radio.
I am learning a different style, not because of radio as much But because of public radio and particularly national public radio, NPR, in commercial radio, one can obviously get away with a different style. There are shock jocks who scream and yell every day in public radio. I mean, commercial radio, nobody cares, you know, if they're a fan of the show. In public radio, particularly NPR, there is this sound that NPR has that is, I think, at best antithetical to the way that I've approached radio. You know, this real soft national public radio kind of thing. And that's not the way I am. That's not my energy level, you know, is significantly higher than that. So within the context of construct of what NPR is, it's something that I work on.
What was your mother's preaching style? Is she still preaching?
She is. My mother is a Pentecostal preacher, charismatic preacher, for those who don't know much about the Pentecostal church. It is, for lack of a better term, high energy. We have a choir. We have in our church, we have a choir, a full choir. We have organ and piano and drums and bass guitar and tambourines. Our church is a high energy church. And so that's the experience out of which I come. And I think it's reflected in part, you know, by who I am. I grew up in this high energy church, if you will.
You say you got your sense of faith from your mother and your sense of being hardworking from your father, who was very hardworking. Mm-hmm. What kind of work did he do?
My father was and still is an Air Force officer, 33, 34 years and counting, still in, went in right after high school. So my father's an Air Force officer, so he's served this country honorably for these many years. And when my parents adopted these four kids, and I should say these four kids, I have seven brothers and two sisters. We all part of one big family of 10. But these four persons who were adopted happened to be my cousins. My mother, my mother's sister, my aunt, was murdered back in 1969, 1970. And those four kids were going to be split up and sent to foster homes, different foster homes, because no one family in Mississippi where they were living, we were living in Indiana at the time, no one family where they were in Mississippi could be found to take all four of them in. So rather than split those four kids up, my parents made the decision, even though my father had a meager Air Force salary, to take those four kids in. And we were all raised together. My parents went on to have a few more kids, and so there ended up being a total of 10 of us. And to this day, I have the utmost respect for my parents because of the love that they have shown me how to practice through their own example.
Thinking of how much authority your parents must have had when you were very young, you know, your mother being a preacher is kind of like the voice of God in the mm-hmm. house, and your father being a military officer has a commanding presence, too. It must have been...
You know,
it's hard to get away with anything.
I never quite thought about it in that way, Terry, but that is a very nice way of putting it and a very interesting way of putting it. I have to call my parents when we get out of the studio here and share with them that description. But that makes a lot of sense. My mother was and is the voice of God, small g, of course, in our household, and my father being a military guy. Although it's funny, my father isn't the typical kind of military guy. My father really is very soft-spoken. He's a disciplinarian. He does what has to be done. He puts his foot down, and you do walk in fear and respect of my father's tactics when it comes to discipline. But at the same time, my mother is much more talkative than my father is, and so that was strange in my household. But my father got your respect with just looking at you in a certain way.
I can imagine what that certain way might have been.
Yeah, he didn't have the military voice. It wasn't, soldier, get over here before I... You know, it wasn't like that, but he had that military look, and he still has it down pat.
Now, in your book, Keeping the Faith, you talk a little bit about what happened to you when you and your sister, when you were in seventh grade, mm-hmm. were accused of creating a disruption in church, something that was particularly embarrassing for your mother because mm-hmm. she was very important in mm-hmm. the church. And this was a public accusation. This was, you know... To the whole gathering of the congregation. Your parents were so angry that your father beat you and your sister. What did he do?
We were a part of a family that believed in discipline. Make no mistake about that. You cannot have 10 kids unless the kids are running the household, which was not the case in my family. You have to be very much disciplinarians, and my parents were. And my parents were very spiritual, and it wasn't just my mother who was involved in the church. My father, although not a preacher, was on the board of trustees and a member of the deacon board at my church. So both of them very deeply involved. So it wasn't even just that they were angry. What led to this horrible incident was that my parents were embarrassed. They were embarrassed to have our minister stand up in front of the entire congregation and scold my sister and I. My sister and I were deeply hurt because we had not caused this public disruption. We were accused of something falsely. But my sister and I were severely beaten. My father got home that night. And rather than beating us with a little belt or, you know, a spanking or whatever, that night he was so enraged that he disconnected from one of the kitchen appliances an extension cord. And we were beaten severely with an extension cord so badly that we were hospitalized both for about 10 days each to recuperate and to be treated for our condition. My sister and I both still have marks on our bodies to this day from that incident, my sister more so than me. And it was an incident that was clearly one of the defining moments, certainly the defining moment of my young life, because I grew up in a small town in Indiana, and so everybody knew about this. And ultimately, my father was dragged into court. My sister and I were both taken out of the home. We went to live with two different foster families. I eventually returned home to my family. My sister, though, Phyllis, never returned home. And that was traumatic for all of us to just lose a sister overnight.
Was that her choice not to return home?
It was her choice. It was her choice. She went to a different foster family and just decided not to come back. But ultimately, it for me became a source of motivation. I determined, Terry, that I would, as an adult, one day return to that community and didn't want to return in embarrassment. And again, speaking of lessons, I mean, I don't know why I even felt like I had done anything wrong, but I was embarrassed by this entire ordeal. I was shamed by this incident in the community because I think in part because as a kid, you're the one who doesn't get believed. Your side of the story doesn't get told. You're not an adult. Sit in the corner and shut up. And especially when the minister of the church, the reverend, the pastor stands up, then you really have nothing to say, and you were wrong, and that's the end of it. But it became a source of inspiration and motivation for me. My sister, by contrast, saw her life tank as a result of that. She went on to have a number of kids out of wedlock, became a crack addict. I'm happy to say to this day, or at this time, she is doing quite well, not doing drugs, working full-time. She's going back to school to get her to college degree. I'm happy to pay for her to do that. So it's turned out, you know, not the worst story, not the worst ending, but it was certainly a traumatic moment in our life.
Here's the paradox with that story. You know, you and your sister ended up being taken away from your parents and put in your foster home. Now, your aunt was murdered when you were a child, and her children, after she was murdered, had no place to go. They first stayed, I think, with your grandmother.
Yes.
When she could no longer take care of them because she became too ill. Rather than watch them go into a foster home, your parents took over their care, and your parents adopted them and brought them up as their children. So here are your parents who have made this tremendous sacrifice in their life to prevent your cousins from having to go to foster homes, and then two of their birth children, you and your sister, are taken from them and put in foster homes. I mean, do you have any sense of how your mother felt about that?
I do. My father, who I love very dearly, and I want to be clear about that, has apologized profusely over the years.
You or to her?
To me and to her. It has been a source of shame and embarrassment for him inside of our family, and now, thanks to this book, for everybody else to read. And I worried about that because I didn't want my father's friends these days may not be aware of this that happened 20-plus years ago. I was concerned about my father's welfare and in the telling of this story. My father has apologized profusely. My mother's burden was one of shame based upon not coming into the room to stop what was going on. But my mother, you know, has lived with that for years, and it's very difficult for her to talk about.
My guest is Tavis Smiley. He hosts a new NPR program, and he has a new book called Keeping the Faith. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Tavis Smiley is my guest, and he's the host of the Tavis Smiley Show on NPR, and he has a new book now called Keeping the Faith. You've said you inherited your work ethic from your father, who was a military officer and also had a lot of part-time jobs to make ends mm-hmm. meet, having to support such a large family. Do you think he liked his work? I mean, you have work that's pretty exciting now, mm-hmm. and you're so well-known now. But what about your father? Did he? You saw him working really hard, but did you see somebody who liked working?
I don't know that my father really or necessarily liked what he did, but he went into the Air Force right out of high school, number one. Number two, my father is the kind of person that he's one of those guys that, one of those persons that does what has to be done. It doesn't so much matter that he necessarily likes it. My father had worked a number of odd jobs, as you mentioned. Most of those odd jobs were cleaning up office buildings late nights.
I guess I'm wondering when you started working really hard, whether your vision of work was something that's really awful but had to be done, or whether you really wanted that you could love and looked hard for that.
I went to college and have worked hard and have tried to educate myself because I never wanted to do manual labor. My father, when he got these little contracts to make ends meet cleaning offices, we became his employees, his 10 kids. And so that was never of interest to me. I swore every trash can I had to empty, every toilet I had to clean, I swore this was not the life for me. And I would always tell my younger brothers and sisters, this is what happens when you don't go to college and get a good education. And what did I know about that? I was a kid myself, but I knew there had to be a better way to make a living than what we were doing. So I don't know if my father liked it. I know that Tavis did not like it. And what's funny about this is that my first job out of college, I went to Los Angeles from Indiana University in Bloomington, where I studied, moved to Los Angeles to work for the late, great Mayor Tom Bradley. And my very first job out of college, I made almost twice as much money as my father was making at that time. And it was almost embarrassing. I felt so bad, Terry, almost guilty making that kind of money. Even though I had those dreams as a child, I almost felt guilty making more than my dad because my dad is the hardest working person I knew. And I felt guilty making more money than my dad.
Now as a broadcaster, your primary subjects have to do with African-American culture and politics. When you grew up, when you were going to elementary school in the Midwest, you say you went to a predominantly white school. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what impact that you think that had on you, or what it was like then to be one of the few mm-hmm. black students in the school?
It was fascinating because it started out, the story has two parts to it. It started out being very challenging for me because I was the only African-American person in mostly all of my classes. Huh. It was difficult because I felt like I had something to prove.
Mm-hmm.
And they did not understand me or see things the way I saw them. They didn't appreciate the kind of music that I liked. They didn't go to the same kind of church that I went to. I was my life experiences were very atypical, you know, antithetical to the experiences that my classmates had. So on certain levels, we could not relate altogether well. And that caused some problems because I felt like I had to prove myself all the time. And so I started, you know, in the third grade with this chip on my shoulder and, you know, being cantankerous and just difficult to get along with because I was different and they were different and I wanted to be accepted for who I was, but I was going about it the wrong way. Somewhere around the seventh grade, things started to change, things started to happen, and I started to see things a little bit differently.
Was this also a predominantly white school?
My entire career. The entire career. But by the seventh or eighth grade, things started to change a little bit differently, changed for me in terms of how I related to my classmates. And by the time I got to high school with this same class of white kids, I ended up being elected class president. And all through high school, I was, you know, the black guy, but I was class president, voted most likely to succeed, and won every award you can imagine, and all of that good stuff. And I just this past summer returned to Indiana for my 20th high school reunion, was the only black guy in the picture, with all of my returning high school classmates. And it's turned out, interestingly, because while I have any number of classmates who've done quite well for themselves, and I don't believe that notoriety or exposure or personality or celebrity makes you better than anybody else, but certainly with regard to achievements, I was the standout at our high school reunion. So it's fascinating how it started out with me having a very difficult time navigating that color line, if you will, But it all panned out, and I was so excited to go back and to see these people, these white kids I went to school with 20 years ago.
You said that you knew in the high school you were known as the black guy. What did it mean, do you think, to the white students to be the black guy?
I don't know. I know that it meant for me not being treated much differently than anybody else, except for the fact that white girls would not go out with me on dates. I never had a date until I was in college, because I went to an all-white school, and that's where my friends were. And for the prom, I was the class president, but never went to the junior prom. I was class president, but didn't go to the senior prom. I couldn't get a date.
Did you have black friends outside of the school?
Oh, yeah, through my church. Through my church. I went to a black church. That I did do.
So where it sounds like you were in a mostly white neighborhood. So where was your mother's church?
The church was about 30 miles away from where we lived.
Oh.
So we lived in two different worlds. My daytime world was this white environment. And there are all kinds of black comedians, indeed, those who I feature on my show every Friday, who make jokes about, you know, trailer park trash or white trash in the trailer parks. Well, I grew up in a trailer park. There were 10 kids, my mother, my father, and my maternal grandmother, who we call Big Mama, 13 of us total, in a trailer. I grew up in a trailer, a three-bedroom trailer, with 13 people. My mother and father had one bedroom. Me and my seven brothers had a second bedroom. And my grandmother and my two sisters had the third bedroom.
Did you feel that, you know, living in two different worlds, the daytime world, which was white, or the weekday world, I should say, which was white, and the weekend world, is that right, which was...
Well, more than weekend. We grew up in a... It's a very good question, though. And for those who know anything about the Pentecostal church, they will relate to this, and I'm sure are laughing as we speak. In the Pentecostal church, it's not a weekend thing. It's an everyday thing.
Right.
We had choir rehearsal on Monday night, prayer meeting on Tuesday night, Bible study on Wednesday night, missionary meeting on Thursday night, young people's meeting on Friday night, prayer meeting on Saturday morning, junior choir rehearsal after prayer meeting on Sunday morning, Sunday school at 9:45, morning worship at 11:30, children's church at 5:30, evening service at 7 o'clock, four services on Sunday, and back again on Monday. I did that every day of my life for 18 years.
Tevis Smiley, thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. I appreciate it.
Tevis Smiley's new book is called Keeping the Faith. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Cloud of Sparrows, the debut novel of 19th century Japan by Takashi Matsuoka. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews the new Charlie Christian box set. Also, we meet Dr. Seema Samar, Afghanistan's former Minister for Women's Affairs and its current head of the Human Rights Commission. And David Bianculli previews tonight's season opener of 24 on Fox.
Yeah.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jazz guitarist Charlie Christian was born in 1912 and grew up in Oklahoma City. While he was in his teens, he jammed with blues guitarist T-Bone Walker and jazz saxophonist Lester Young. Benny Goodman hired Christian for his sextet in 1939, and within months he was the most acclaimed guitarist in jazz. But his triumph was short. Christian died of tuberculosis in 1942 at the age of 25. A new box set centers on Charlie Christian's recordings with Goodman. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Charlie Christian and Lionel Hampton on vibraphone, 1939. There had been electric guitarists before Charlie Christian, but not many, and most played Hawaiian slide guitar. Christian changed everything because he phrased and let notes ring out like a horn player, like saxophonist Lester Young much of the time. Early jazz soloists would usually bear down on the rhythm, but Young seemed to float above it by placing a stream of notes just before or behind the beat. You can hear what Christian got from him on a 1940 Benny Goodman session they both played on. Here's Lester Young on Lester's Dream. On Charlie Christian's solo, you can really hear that he and Lester Young spoke the same rhythmic language. Charlie Christian with a Benny Goodman octet from the 4-CD set The Genius of the Electric Guitar. It's mostly devoted to the Goodman small groups that made Christian an instant jazz hit. The box includes a batch of newly heard alternate takes and a couple of long rehearsal sequences in which we hear Goodman make a leader's classic request to a guitar player, "Turn your volume down!" Much of this stuff has been out before or is available on European issues, but at best, the sound of Christian's guitar is clearer than I've ever heard it. You can really hear the steel strings vibrate and the nuances of how he attacks a note. This is Royal Garden Blues from the fall of 1940 when Goodman's sextet was really wailing. That's Cootie Williams on trumpet and Count Basie on piano. From that solo, you can hear how Charlie Christian's country twang influenced early rockers, the way his tone and timing set the standard for jazz pickers. To say he introduced the modern electric guitar is barely an exaggeration. Oklahoma was part of the southwestern jazz continuum where swing feeling, blues inflections, and string bands had come to an easy understanding. The southwestern smoothness Count Basie personified had infected most jazz by the late 1930s. Having a dependable pulse behind them gave soloists like Christian something to phrase against, but he could also get down in the groove with the rest of the band. The next step in jazz's evolution was to get whole groups to play weird accents and off-center phrases, like Christian or Lester Young taking a solo. That was the birth of bebop. Charlie Christian was in on that too, jamming after hours in Harlem with Dizzy Gillespie and Thelonious Monk. It's the one key part of his story missing from this new box set. There are a few live tracks floating around, however. This next bit of music comes from the CD After Hours on the OJC label, which shows how Christian sounded with his volume turned up. The drummer is bebop pioneer Kenny Clark. There's a bit of the influence of gypsy guitarist Django Reinhardt in there, and on a few of Charlie Christian's sides with Benny Goodman. The box, The Genius of the Electric Guitar, gets a solid A for production values and a low F for packaging. The CDs are housed in a flimsy and too big cardboard box, tarted up to look like a guitar amp. The moment I got the shrink wrap off my copy, the bass slid out and onto the floor, and one CD popped out of its precarious perch, wedged into a bed of plastic foam. I don't get the logic here. This is smart music, intelligently prepared and annotated, and then packaged as if consumers were dummies.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed Charlie Christian, The Genius of the Electric Guitar, on the Columbia label. Coming up, Dr. Seema Sumar, Afghanistan's first minister for women's affairs and the current head of the country's new Human Rights Commission. This is Fresh Air. Now that women are no longer forced to submit to the Taliban's harsh rule in Afghanistan, my guest, Dr. Seema Sumar, is one of the few women who have risen to positions of importance in the new government. After the fall of the Taliban, she became Afghanistan's first minister for women's affairs. Under pressure by Islamic extremists, she was forced out of that position. She's now the head of the country's first Human Rights Commission. During the Loya Jirga, she was vice chair to Hamid Karzai, the current leader of Afghanistan. Dr. Sumar just won a Human Rights Award from the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights. On her trip to the United States, I asked her if there were things she said working with Karzai or when she was Minister of Women's Affairs that were particularly controversial.
Nothing was controversial, actually. When I was asking for women's participation in different sections, they were just kind of looking at me that I don't understand or I'm crazy somehow. Because I really wanted the women's participation to be really realistic in the country, not only symbolic. They want somebody to be a minister of women's affairs and sitting and not doing anything or be quiet, not fight with them for everything. But I was not able to do that. Very simple. I was asking them that when they made a commission for coordinating aid to Afghanistan, and I said, can I be part of it? And they said, why? A woman should be part of it. And I said, well, I feel that there's a need, and I want to know the plan you're making for the country, how gender-sensitized it is.
Did you feel like you got support from Hamid Karzai?
Not much, unfortunately. I think he was saying that when we are making road, it's for both, for men and women. Mm-hmm. So why are you worried about it?
So you had to explain yourself all the time.
Yeah, first of all, to explain all the time, and secondly, most of the time they were not giving chance to me to speak. So that was a really difficult position. But I'm proud to say that I was really able to establish the Ministry of Women's Affairs. And the Ministry of Women's Affairs is much organized and does have its long-term strategy than any other ministry now.
Let's talk a little bit about your life. Your father had two wives, and your mother was his first wife. What did your father think of women's rights, and what did your mother think?
Well, both of my mother, unfortunately, are illiterate. They are very traditional. They think that what they do is their job. Very simple, as all the other women in our country. My father was, I mean, he really believed on educating the children. But even for him, there was a difference between boys and girls. Of course, the preference was for the boys, not for the girls. And for us, he was ready to give us the education, to allow us to go to school up to a certain time. But this was not limited for the boys.
You got married before you went to medical school. How did your husband feel about you going?
Well, that was part of our agreement, because I said that I'm not interested to marry unless he really support me on education, because I want to continue my education. And he was really supportive. He did support a lot. But then he was taken by the Russian when I was in fourth year, and he never came.
So you were still in medical school when he was taken away. You stayed in medical school, completed your time?
Yes, I did. I continued because I was in fourth year, so I had to study another 3 years.
Did you ever see him again?
No.
In 1984, you went to Pakistan from Afghanistan. Why did you go?
I went to Quetta, Balochistan, which is does have a lot of refugees. And I was working in a hospital for refugees, which was run by Interchurch Aid. And then I decided that this was the only hospital which had a female branch on it, female section. But this hospital was only functioning from 8 o'clock to 2 o'clock, and they were not attending any emergency cases. Then I decided to start a hospital for women and children. I did start a hospital for women and children in 87. So that was the way I started. Then I started some girls' school. Then I started some hospital and schools in Afghanistan. Now I run 4 hospitals, 10 clinics. 57 school with more than 37 students, boys and girls, and some income generation project, a lot of literacy course for women.
When you were in Pakistan and started setting up women's hospitals and schools for girls, were you familiar with the madrasas that were being set up there by Islamic extremists that were in part training boys who were refugees from Afghanistan?
Absolutely. I was seeing in 85 there was a new camp built in one part of Balochistan. So newly established clinic, and I was going there. It was under the tent. Beside the clinic, it was a huge building with a high wall was built very quickly, and it was madrasa. So my question was, on that time, I was not thinking that they are becoming in power one day in Afghanistan. My fear was that these poor boys, why they should be in prison in order to get education? And I saw the difference that how much money is going to build a madrasa and how much money is going to build a clinic. Because the madrasa has got a high wall and really rooms on it and building. We were under the tent and we just built maybe a 1.5 meter high wall around the tent in order to protect the dust not enter the tent. And nobody was really there. No UN agency, no other international community to support the formal education, because they would say that we just do the emergency work. And education is long-term development work, which was a big, big mistake. It's not unfortunate that we lost all those generations without education.
You have a son. Were you worried when he was young that he would be influenced by the extremists who would want to train him to be a man who did not respect the rights of women?
Not Exactly, because he was my son, mm-hmm. and he does have a lot of respect for women's rights, and he's very nice and supportive son. And I really didn't give any kind of chance for him to be influenced by the religious extremists. One of these political party, fundamentalist party, wanted to kidnap him in order to make me leave the country or leave the work I do, because they were not happy with the women's program from the very beginning.
So did they succeed in kidnapping him?
No. He was locked for, three weeks at home. He was under house arrest, and we were able to somehow protect him.
How old was he then?
He was 7 or 8 years old when I started all these things.
What did you tell him about needing to be brave? Did you talk to him about that?
Well, he was so clever and supportive that he was telling me that we should be brave, we should be strong. Because he was knowing about the whole things. I tried to not tell him that his father is lost or arrested. And then one day he was 5 years old, he told me that, oh, don't try to lie to me. I know what's happened to my father. So don't worry, I'll be old and I'll be... On that time, he said he's going to be mujahid and fight against the Russian in order to protect his father or to protect the country.
Where does your son live now?
My son is studying in this country.
In the United States?
Yes.
And are you grateful that he's out of Afghanistan now?
I'm grateful that because it's not easy in Afghanistan to be a single parent and brought somebody up, some child, the way you want. So he loves to go and he will go. He's only on a student visa. He's studying in this country. Last year when the announcement was made, he said he's going because I'm alone and he wants to help me. But I said, finish your study and then go. Afghanistan has a long way to go, so don't rush. He's very cooperative. He's very nice.
Do you know a lot of women in Afghanistan now who don't seem to want to have more rights, who think that they should be behind the veil and who think that they should remain in the house and who think that men are much better and more important and smarter and all the other things than women are?
Yes, unfortunately, because the literacy rate is very low in the country. The majority of the people are illiterate. When you have enough educated women, you have less violence, you have less problem for the woman because they know what is their right. In our country, I think 98% of women are illiterate.
Have you tried to talk to women who resist women's rights?
I did try the women's, yes. They're not really resisting, but they say that they're not as strong as I am, or they don't understand. And very simply, they reply that, well, we have to obey the husband, otherwise who's going to feed us? You're a medical doctor, so you can earn your own money. We are not in that position.
Well, so when a woman says to you, well, sure, it's easy for you. You're a doctor. You make a living. How can I be independent? Mm-hmm. My husband would cut me off and I wouldn't be able to eat. What do you say to them?
Well, I keep trying and pushing them to, okay, let's do and learn this job. That's why I do run some projects which give the women some skill and they can stand on their own feet, especially the widows. But, of course, it's very difficult to get the money. We are absolutely depend on outsider. But we really try on this matter.
Now, you've been called the Salman Rushdie of Afghanistan. Salman Rushdie had a fatwa against him. He had a death threat against him. Do you think your life is in danger? Do you need any protection?
Yes, the life is in danger. I already have a lot of protection by some people, but still I have bodyguards and I walk around everywhere with gunmen.
Do you think that the gunmen and bodyguards who are protecting you support your women's rights work?
Oh, yes, yeah, yes. These are the people who has been working with me maybe 15 years. And these are the boys that somehow I arranged their marriages and everything. So it's almost like my sons, my family.
You arranged their marriages?
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about that, about how you did it?
Yes. For example, one of these boys has no mother and no father. He was with us and working. And since 87, he is with me in the hospital. And then there was another family, another lady who had a daughter and a son, and her husband was also killed. And this girl was... I proposed and she was happy to marry this boy, and we just did the marriage and everything, and now they have three children, and they are happy, and both of them is really kind of thankful to me that I was able to direct their life. But before that, he was working here and there, and he had no option. But now he has a family and he has everything. And he really respects me. He called me mother.
That's great.
So this is something that, I mean, it's few people like this that I really kept since long time since. Still, if they have some problem, I'm the judge to solve it. So this is the way that we work.
Well, I wish you very good luck with your work and with your safety. And I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Seema Samar is the head of Afghanistan's new Human Rights Commission. Last week in New York, she received a Human Rights Award from the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights. Coming up, TV critic David Bean Cooley on the season premiere of 24. This is Fresh Air. Tonight on Fox, the serialized action drama 24 returns for a second season. TV critic David Bianculli has been waiting impatiently for this series to start again, but he reports quite happily that it's worth the wait.
Last season, 24 was the most daring experimental series on network television. Kiefer Sutherland starred as counterterrorist agent Jack Bauer, a man assigned to protect a prominent presidential candidate from a planned assassination. The experimental part was that the entire plot, as well as a second storyline about Jack's wife and daughter being kidnapped, unfolded in real time. Each hour of the show was an hour in Jack's life, with the clock ticking incessantly. 24 hours and 24 episodes later, Jack's day was done. The candidate was safe. The traitor in Jack's organization was uncovered. Jack's daughter was safe, too. But in an amazing and unexpected cliffhanger, Jack's wife was killed by the traitor at virtually the last minute. That's what happened last season. What happened this summer, when 24 was off the air, was even more significant. Executives at Fox, the networks presenting 24, asked the producers to rethink the show's concept. Do it in three separate 8-hour storylines, maybe, or condense events so that each show was one hellish day in Jack's life. The producers tried writing one such script, but fought for the uniqueness of the original concept, and finally won. So now we start the second season. It's a year later, and Jack has been inactive the whole time, too grief-stricken over the murder of his wife to go back to work. The politician whose life he saved, Senator Palmer, is President Palmer now. and Jack's daughter Kim is estranged from Jack, keeping him at a distance while starting a new job as a nanny. As the first new show begins, counting down its 24-hour day beginning at 8 a.m., Palmer learns of a horrifying threat against the United States. Terrorists are planning to detonate a nuclear device in or above Los Angeles sometime that day. So Palmer reaches out to phone the one person he trusts to handle that sort of responsibility and pressure. Dennis Haysbert plays President Palmer.
How's it all going, Jack?
It's been difficult, sir.
I'm sure it has. I thought a lot about you this past year.
Well, thank you, Mr. President.
Jack, I know this is a bad time, but I need your help.
Sir, I've been inactive for over a year. I can't see how I'd be of any help to anyone.
We are in the middle of a grave situation that requires the attention of all branches of our national security. My advisors are convinced that you can play an important part in this effort.
Mr. President, I'm sorry, but I'm in no condition.
Jack, listen to me. I know you suffered a loss. I know it's hard, but this is not a routine request. Go to CTU. Listen to what's happening, and then make your decision. Jack. You saved my life. I trust you as much as I trust anyone, and now I need your help.
When do they need me?
Now.
Man, I love those ka-chunks. That's the high-intensity way 24 switches scenes or goes to a commercial break. Except that for tonight's show, there are no commercial breaks because there aren't any commercials. The primary plot is a thrilling one, and Jack's angry and unstable emotional state makes things even more tense. Before this first hour is over, Jack will do some things that make Michael Chiklis' rogue cop on The Shield look like a model of restraint. And like the show, he's just getting started. The parallel plot about Jack's daughter Kim, though, begins very implausibly and way too coincidentally. But 24 had its lapses last season, too. Remember Jack's wife getting amnesia for a few episodes? And it still delivered the goods. Just as the president has faith in Jack, I have faith in 24. This show has me hooked, and the first 2 hours this season haven't let me down. Give the show 1 hour, and I bet you'll be just as eager to see the remaining 23.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by DK Publishing, publisher of Bill Wyman's Rolling with the Stones, the inside story of the rock and roll band told by a man who can tell it like it was. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, new information about how the Allies won World War II and their efforts to ensure that post-war Germany would not produce another Hitler. We talk with historian Michael Beschloss, author of The Conquerors, Roosevelt, Truman, and the Destruction of Hitler's Germany. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.